We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hey, you're listening to Sordid Cinema, official podcast of SordidCinema.com. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Ricky D.
Hey, Simon, what's up?
Not too much. We're also here with Mr. Patrick Murphy.
Yeah, exactly. What is up? Not too much.
Yeah. We don't actually care what's up with you, Patrick. Nobody asked you.
You're going to care even less today, I think. No, I'm kidding. We'll get to this. I liked both of these movies, just to varying degrees. Maybe not as much as you guys.
Well, since I guess, you know, everyone's ears are burning already today, if you haven't noticed from, you know, the name of the post or the name of the podcast or anything, we're here to talk about two, not one, but two new genre films. One new-ish American genre films, Green Room and I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. The connection, of course, between the two films is that they share creatives. Green Room was directed by Jeremy Saulnier, and that film co-stars Macon Blair. Macon Blair is the director of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which he also wrote. And there are different films, but they have a lot in common, and I think that the common ground between them should make for some interesting discussion. So, yeah, I don't think there's too much more I want to mention before that, except do check out SordidCinema.com. We've been making some moves lately, bringing in some new contributors. We got lots of stuff going up. We're very excited about the present and especially the future. We're doing stuff. We're really doing it. If you haven't already, do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and or Stitcher and or Google Play, or, you know, you could always just support the website in a tiny little way by playing the podcast there. And ratings and reviews and all that stuff all help with visibility. That helps us out. Anyway, I guess let's get to it. I want us to start with Macon Blair's movie, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which is out now on Netflix. So the vast majority of y'all should be able to stream it. Let's hear a clip.
A freaky, freaky dancer.
My house got robbed.
What did they take?
My grandma's silver.
Did you call the authorities?
Yeah.
The world is bigger than your silverware. Grow up.
Everyone is an asshole. Taking my mind.
Stop.
Sometimes I feel like I'm underneath a whirlpool. Like, I can't even breathe. The way people treat each other
makes me so furious! Kevin, stop it! Is there anything I can do?
Open sesame. Gotcha.
Police!
Your son broke into my house.
I have no idea where he is.
Vigilante action's a good way to get your wig knocked off.
You have beautiful eyes, okay?
What do you want?
For people to not be assholes. I'm not letting you shoot anyone. Anyone else.
That was a clip from I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, a new satirical thriller, dark comedy, slash a couple other things, written and directed by Macon Blair in his feature debut, starring Melanie Lynskey as Ruth, a nursing assistant whose life is a bit of a shambles, and she finds herself feeling increasingly vengeful towards a society that she feels is on a steady decline. which ends up in a on a path of increasing danger, peril, and violence. And Elijah Wood is also here, along with Jane Levy, who people may remember from Don't Breathe and some other stuff. And special shout out to David Yao, who is the for people who don't know who he is, he's more or less the big bad of this film. He's also the lead singer for the Jesus Lizard, aka one of the greatest rock bands, American rock bands of the last like 30 years. So that's kind of a cool tidbit that I just wanted to get out of the way so I can not mention it again. Anyway, I know that Ricky, we're going to be talking about Green Room a little later in this episode, which, spoiler alert, we're really big fans of. And I believe that I hooked you onto the idea of covering this movie on the podcast by saying, hey, there's some associated creatives here. So, I mean, what do you think is going on with this crew and the movies they're making?
Green Room is my favorite film of 2016. We will talk about Green Room after the break. So I was pretty excited after I heard that it was the same people involved in the making of Green Room and Blue Ruin. For a first-time feature, I think that this is a fantastic first-time feature. I'm kind of confused as to why it was made for Netflix. Like, I kind of feel like this movie could have had a nice theatrical release and made some bit of money. I could be wrong, but it's a really funny film, guys. Like, it's kind of violent at times, but it's like a mix of neo-noir and gentle indie comedy, and it reminds me of like the best of the early Coen brothers films. What I find strange is a lot of people have compared it to the Michael Douglas film Falling Down. I don't think it's at all similar to Falling Down, like in terms of tone, in terms of like maybe to some degree the story, but not really. But I like the way the film leans more on comedy than violence, because I actually find this film to be extremely funny. Now, the problem is, with comedy, like, I can find something incredibly funny, but you might not. And so I'm not entirely sure if our listeners have seen this film, if they're going to want to watch this film. They might find it as funny as you and I, Simon, or they might not. I think he did a great job in balancing, at times, slapstick comedy, sly comedy, dark comedy, and extreme violence. And I also love the performances across the board. First of all, can I ask, Melanie Lynskey, right? Like, she's Melanie Lynskey from, like, Peter Jackson, Heavenly Creatures, The Frighteners. Melanie yeah. Lynskey.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't people use her more often in better films? Because she is a great actress, and she's fantastic here. Also, I should note that I am, like, the biggest fan of Elijah Wood in this world, and I had no clue Elijah Wood was in his film. So when Elijah Wood pops up and he plays this really goofball looking like character named Tony, who likes to throw around like ninja stars and beat people up, I was just like sold. I'm like, I love his performance throughout the whole entire film. So I have a lot to say about this movie. Overall, I just think that it won me over with its unique charm and oddball humor. And I love the performances.
How about you, Patrick? Were you similarly sold?
I found this movie just a little more mediocre, I guess. I do think it's pretty good for a first-time feature. I think it definitely shows that it's a first-time effort. He definitely plays it safe in a lot of parts. I think where he really excelled, though, is that slapstick, sort of treading that line between slapstick and dark comedy, I guess, in the violence and just sort of the shot. He really did a good job making the violence both shocking and kind of funny, darkly funny, obviously, not just laugh out loud. You know, I think Rick's right. It did have the violence for sure. Had a Coen Brothers feel. The rest of it, I think he played it just a little too bland for me. I like the performances. I really like Elijah Wood in this. I'm so on Melanie Lynskey. I thought she was kind of one note for most of the movie, but I also don't think that the characters were very well written. I don't think that they paid enough attention to these characters, and I would have liked to have known more about them. There are way too many sort of musical interlude scenes where it's just the characters looking at something and there's music playing. There's a lot of that in this, as almost to make up for a script that wasn't fully fleshed out, I feel. And yet there's also some bizarrely fleshed out stuff with the villains who I felt were not interesting at all. And we could have completely gotten away from them. They were kind of unimportant to the main parts of the story. And when the movie shifts focus to them occasionally, it totally sucked away from what the you know, the main themes that it was dealing with, and the two main characters that were, that could have been much more interesting, I think, than they ended up being. But at the same time, I do like the look of this movie, and I like the vibe of it quite a bit. So that was enough to carry me through. I just wasn't, you know, 100% sold. I do think it's a very good first-time effort, though.
Patrick, I'm going to totally agree with you that on a narrative level, it's somewhat paper thin. And I think the introduction of those villains that you're speaking of, it feels somewhat awkward, and it shifts the focus away from the main character, Ruth, who I actually think she's like the most interesting character in a film, and also Tony, played by Elijah Wood. And so therefore, it doesn't feel organic, and it's not as entertaining watching those villains, who we know little about, when you completely shift the focus away for us, the viewers, because most of the film is in the point of view of Ruth. So it is an awkward tonal shift.
Yeah, and she is interesting. I wanted to know more about her, and I kind of got frustrated when the movie would go away from her and wouldn't let her speak. Like, I wanted to know more of her viewpoint on things, but it doesn't really give her a chance to breathe as much as I thought that she could.
Can I tell you, you're both wrong? I love this movie. I like it almost as much as I like Green Room. I have personal reasons that I love Green Room so much. I don't know if they're the same reasons that Ricky loves it so much, but I actually think the villainry in the movie is really interesting. To be clear, you know, the characters we're talking about are David Yao's Marshall, Jane Levy's Dez, and the other one. let's be honest. They're really the blonde kid. Unfortunately, I don't have the actor's name handy, but
Devin Gray.
Thank you. Devin Gray as Christian Rumack Jr. Of course, it's all coming back to me. I think that they're actually very interesting in the context of the movie for a few reasons. One, I like that they're sort of a demented family unit. They're kind of like a really inept Manson family. And I like the way that their sense of sort of perverted family or eroded family contrasts with Ruth, who is pointedly alone in her life. You know, you get the feeling from her, you know, depressing interactions with men, one of whom is played amusingly by Macon Blair, that, you know, she's wanted connections in life, but, you know, people have just been relentlessly disappointing. And I don't think we need to have her explain to us in, you know, in a monologue or whatever, that that's what's happened. I think that's clear from Linsky's performance and from the few interactions we see. And I think to have her come up against this, this kind of perverted nuclear family is a really interesting choice. And another interesting choice is not only the casting of David Yao, but the way that the first time we see Marshall, yeah, the way that he's hidden in the woods like an almost supernatural villain, and he seems like this almost supernaturally malevolent presence. But it's, you know, because we're seeing him in this firelight in the middle of the woods, and he seems like a force to be reckoned with. And then over the next half hour, we gradually see that he's just kind of a lowlife and an idiot. And there's something about how even the villainry of this movie is very like down to earth, and it feels very very much like of a piece with this movie that's about, you know, the decay of society. It's like we can't even get proper movie villains anymore. We've just got these assholes. I don't know. I kind of appreciated that.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And don't get me wrong, I love this movie. I don't know if I like it as much as you, but I like it enough to put on my top 10 of the year so far, maybe even my top 5. In terms of like the contrast between that family and her character, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting point, but it's not really deep. You know what I mean? It's just, it is what it is. I mean, as far as those villains go, I just did not find them as interesting as you do. Like, even in terms of like how they contrast her character, like, I think what I like about this movie is I like Ruth, and like, I mean, Patrick, you say we don't know a lot about her, and I totally disagree. I think we know a lot about her. We know about her occupation, we know about her past, her family, her current like social life. We know that she is incredibly depressed. She's having an incredibly bad day, and she's fed up with society. I think that this is a film that a lot of people can relate to, because it's about social norms and what people just think is acceptable these days, when really it shouldn't be and isn't. I mean, every single person in this movie is so selfish and out for themselves and has absolutely no care in the world for anyone surrounding them, like be it like the police officer or the lady working as a cashier at the local supermarket, or the neighbor who lets his dog poop on her lawn. the thing about her is, like, I'm trying to figure out if she's supposed to be some sort of modern day Travis Bickle. Like, she's angry at society and she has reasons to be angry at society, but she doesn't resort to violence. Well, sort of, not really. I mean, she becomes a victim of violence and resorting to violence in order to sort of like survive, I guess, the third act. I'll leave it at that. But sorry, I like how she becomes like sort of like a Nancy Drew character, and it becomes sort of like her own personal detective story, because here's a lady who's incredibly depressed, doesn't have really much in her life that brings her happiness. And the story is that someone breaks into her house because she leaves the door, her back door open, and they steal her laptop, and it gives her sort of like a new purpose, at least for like a day or two. She can go on this like mission and become like her own personal detective and hunt down who stole her laptop. And it might seem silly and small, but for her, it just, I don't know, it brings her some sort of like purpose in her life, at least within that short span of time.
I don't know what the fuck that is.
Okay, we don't want any trouble. My computer was stolen, and this says that it's in there. I just want it back. There's no questions. So, can you get it?
I can get these nuts.
You can get these nuts?
All right, tough guy. You had your chance.
Oh.
So, like, it's just interesting how she's, like, a very timid woman who likes to listen to alt country, and she reads novels, and she gets really mad when someone spoils the novel, the ending of the novel for her. And she is just surrounded by all of these people who just don't care about anybody nowadays. And, like, I think that's why, like, I mean, Simon, you called me up, I think, right after you watched the movie, and you said that there was two lines in this movie that reminded you of me. And it's when she says something like, I just wish people in life would stop being assholes. It's not like this grand sort of like crime caper film where she gets involved in some kind of like bank heist. It's at least she becomes like a victim to social norms, which, again, should not be norms. Like,
but I mean, at the same time, though, something I really appreciate about this movie is that the characters are all fundamentally the same in that, yes, they are out for themselves, that no one has this, you know, grand scheme to necessarily, like, you know, you said there's no grand caper. Everyone is really just trying to get by. Even the villains ultimately are just trying to get by. And they're in, you know, they're in this sort of dim circumstance where they're living out of a van. They're getting beaten up by drug dealers and you know, and gun dealers and stuff. You know, their lives are pretty squalid. There and you know the family connection we get through one of the thieves and his dad, like, clearly that whole household, despite their, you know, their affluence, is just as much a place of squalor and misery. And you know no one is let off the hook for their, you know, for their relentless self-interest. And if anything, the Ruth character just moves from one plane of self-interest where no one is getting, you know, hurt except for her, to this other plane of self-interest where people are actively hurting each other.
Well, and she hurts people too.
She does.
Yeah.
Her entire motivations are selfish innate. Like, she's no better, I think, than the people that she decries. And that was one of my reasons for having a hard time. I couldn't really root for Ruth, because ultimately I feel she is a very unlikable character in many respects. She's not too far off from the people that she despises. And it was very easy to root for Tony, Elijah Wood's character, because he is the only selfless one in the entire movie. He is the only one that's actually doing something for someone else. And she kind of treats him like garbage, really, in many respects. But he is helping. And yet it was frustrating to watch. I didn't mind watching a character do that, because I liked that they explored. She wasn't this perfect person who was always doing nice things for people and being taken advantage of all the time. She was essentially someone who maybe she followed the rules a little bit better than the rest of society. She followed some courtesy rules that we have, but she was never actively making anything better or even trying. She was kind of wallowing in self-pity, and eventually something happens to it spurs her to basically think, well, you know what? If everybody's going to be an asshole, so I'm going to be an asshole too. And that right. I liked the, you know, the idea that they could explore that, but I just didn't think that they did. I didn't think that they took it far enough. I didn't think that they really did much with that, because then they want us to see these villains who, I just don't think that they had much of a point. And in that third act involving the villains just kind of seemed ridiculous and completely out of character. It sort of came out of left field, really, how these little simple thieves turn into psychopathic, you know, killers.
Yeah. And the thing about Elijah Wood's character, Tony, is that he makes her a far more interesting character and far more likable. Like, because I loved watching this odd pair of heroes, and I actually did root for them as a duo. You know what I mean? Like, there is something darkly alluring about watching them, but I'm still siding with Patrick. Like, I don't have a problem with the third act, like as I normally do when we review movies on this podcast. I just, I feel like those characters are just the least interesting thing about this film, which, again, I love this movie. Do not get me wrong. I also love the way it's edited. I think they did a fantastic job editing this film. Like, there's one specific phone call she makes in which she's like expressing her frustration for all of these things that have been happening to her lately. And we get a cut, and it turns out she's talking to this like 5-year-old girl at the other end of the line, right? She has no idea. She's just like expressing her frustration, and like little moments like that, I thought it was like a great, like, again, like, I think the comedy works, and it works great throughout this whole entire film. In terms of like the visual grammar, like the way he builds suspense, I mean, he's no Jeremy Saulnier, right? He might have worked with him and starred in his pictures. He's not there yet in terms of like being a director, in terms of like telling the story visually. There are like moments like of brutal violence, like there's bursts of violence, and again, it's kind of slapstick, which I actually really, really liked, especially in the third act. I thought like it is gory, you know, like brains do splatter and blood gets shed, but it's also darkly funny. And I think the star of this movie is Elijah Wood, but I think the second star would be the film editor. And I don't know who the film editor is, but he did a fantastic job. I love the editing scheme throughout the whole entire film. I also need to give a quick shout out to the guy who did the score, who, if I'm not mistaken, is related to him. I think it's his sibling, right?
So the music is actually credited to two, I assume, siblings, Brooke Blair and Will Blair, and the editing was done by Tomas Vengris.
Okay, because the soundscape, and I'm gonna say the same thing about Green Room, but the soundscape is impressive. Like, it's a major plus for the movie. So like, Patrick, when you talk about moments in which the characters sort of like do little, and they're just like moments of like musical interludes, I guess, I actually really, really liked those moments. Like, I think it just helps with the pacing of the film. Like, the film, it's a very patient film in telling its story, whatever little story it does have to tell. And in terms of like focusing on these characters, and as a director, he's not afraid to be patient and just let the camera linger. And I like that. But like, again, I'm sort of like in between you and Simon this week, because I love the movie almost as much as Simon, but I do still have a problem with those villains.
The
director of photography is the same guy who shot Swiss Army Man, and he does a really fantastic job too, considering that I'm pretty sure they had like a small budget to work with.
A couple things I wanted to say. You asked at the top of the show why this is on Netflix and not, you know, for instance, on a limited theatrical run. The answer to that is that Netflix has more money than God, and they're trying to get, as you know, they're trying to get, you know, a diverse set of original content. And they're ultimately, yes, like they might have had a successful theatrical run and maybe been a higher profile, but I guarantee you Netflix like gave them a dump truck of money for the rights to this movie, and that's pretty much what happened.
I'm assuming they bought it at Sundance.
Probably.
Because this film debuted at Sundance. I'm assuming that Netflix just bought it there.
Yes, and again, I'm sure it was tons of money, and I'm sure they did very well. The other thing is, I have to disagree with you both to a certain degree about the Elijah Wood character, who is quite possibly the biggest psychopath in this movie. Like, let's be clear. Like, Yes, he is a lovable psychopath, but you know, this is a guy who's clearly just itching. He's been preparing his whole life for a chance to play the superhero. He is basically like a character out of a movie like James Gunn's Super. Like, he loves the concept of having a mission. Like, even more than that's really what unites Tony and Ruth, is that they feel like they have a mission. The difference is that Tony is really ready for violence. He's got weapons, and I think probably the funniest moment of the whole movie is, what do you call that thing that he brings to the first encounter with the ball and chain thing?
A morning star.
Is that the thing with the ball and the?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. The ball and chain is a morning star.
Okay.
There are ninja throwing stars, but the morning star is like a mace with spikes on it.
Right. The sequence where, I mean, it's not really a major spoiler, but someone wrests the Morningstar from his hands, and then what happens over the next 30 seconds or so is riotously funny. And the I think that really the slapstick slash almost splatstick that happens in parts of this movie is really beautifully edited and choreographed and performed, and is, I think we can all agree, is kind of the highlight. We may not agree on the thematic stuff, but that stuff is really, really nicely done, especially for a first feature.
Especially the hit and run. The hit and run is amazing.
Yes.
Like, I cannot stop laughing.
He's so good at using violence as a punctuation. That was his definite strength. Because his staging of the actors in normal scenes isn't anything. It's kind of bland. Whatever. It works. It's not terrible or anything like that. But his staging, I thought, for the violence, that's when he really showed his chops as a director. And he uses that violence as such great punctuation that makes you gasp and laugh at the same time, which... It was great. And those are definitely the highlights.
And like the hit and run, like if you read it in a script, you'd be like, okay, I've seen this beat before. Like I've seen this as a cap to a sequence, and it's always shot the same way, and you see it coming literally a mile away, and it's like whatever. And here it's just done better than I've seen it done in a very long time. I want to say also there, it's probably not really intentional, or you know, if they did think about it, like it was, you know, sort of they were probably privately amused and left it at that. But there's something really satisfying and something like extra satisfying about having Melanie Lynskey in this role, because you mentioned, you know, she had kind of a star turn when she was very young in Heavenly Creatures, which obviously she was great in. But ever since then, she's really had a long parade of supporting roles, some of which were very good. Like even mediocrity is like Sam Mendes' The Way We Go. Like, I remember her having like a really great, really heartrending subplot in that movie. And, you know, she's gotten some time to shine here and there, but I can't think of her since then ever having had a starring role. And to have her sort of as this world-weary character stepping into the spotlight for the first time kind of has like an extra layer of satisfaction from her casting.
I don't know, man. Like, again, I'm like the biggest fan of Elijah Wood. So for me, he was the punctuation mark of this film. And I thought his character was by far the most interesting. Yes, he's like the craziest, but he's also the most sympathetic. He does become like the victim at the very end, like because of her. Like, you know what I mean? He's trying his best to help. And yeah, there is, it is to some degree selfish, but not really. I think he really does want to help her. Like her, he's missing something in his life that makes him feel good. And so this adventure, this like detective story, just gives him some sort of purpose apart from like walking his dog. Also, he's, he's a dog lover.
Which, and of course, he dog, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Love the dog too.
As
right?
soon as there's a dog, you're in the bag for that character.
Kevin.
Although I guess that gets complicated with Green Room.
What did you guys think of the payoff really quick? I thought it was really out of... I don't want to obviously spoil it or anything like that, but the actual very, very end, the resolution of this thing, I thought felt out of place and not in step with the rest of the movie.
Oh my God! You mean like the last 30 seconds, say? Oh yeah, that was bizarre.
I almost agree with you. I think the only reason it's not totally out of place is because of a previous sequence. Patrick, you mentioned that there are these sort of musical montage sequences where people are just sitting around listening to music. That's kind of true, except there's one sequence where people aren't just sitting around listening to music. They actually kind of break the fourth wall in a sequence set to Echo and the Bunnymen, where they're sitting in church and the priest is mouthing along to the words like suddenly they're in a music video, and it's like a dreamlike sort of fugue state moment. And that, so in a weird way, that sequence kind of presages the very ending, which seems to be not quite real. I feel like they could have like laid. I think there needed to be one or two more sequences like that one for the groundwork to really be laid. I agree that it's not that well developed, but I don't know if it's totally out of left field.
It's confusing. Let's put it that way. I didn't pick up on the same sort of vibes as I got from the church sequence in that end, but just even the way it's shot too, with the lens flare and everything like that, things are a little bit hazy and fuzzy. And you're right, it could be dreamlike, but it just seemed a little weird and out of place.
I mean, first feature, these things happen.
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah. I mean, that's a small little nit.
Well, you know what? Jeremy Saulnier, his first feature I absolutely love. It's called Murder Party. It's a great film, but it's nowhere near as brilliant as the second film. So, and this is far better than Murder Party. So I want to see what he does next.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, I like Blue Ruin. But I think I like this better than Blue Ruin.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, totally.
So there you go. I am also extremely curious to see where he goes after this, if he just ends up sort of making the leap that I think Saulnier did. But speaking of Saulnier, let's stop teasing it and get into Green Room. Let's just keep, we're about to do a punk rock movie, so let's do the punk rock thing and just get right into it. Let's hear a clip from Jeremy Saulnier's Green Room.
All right. I can get you guys a solid gig. Matinee tomorrow, doors at 1, you guys are on at 3.
Gentlemen.
You're trapped. Things have gone south. It won't end well.
You can't keep us here, man. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
Shoot who is left. Let him bleed.
Get ready to run.
Here we go.
Careful now.
That was a clip from Green Room, directed by Jeremy Saulnier, also written by Jeremy Saulnier, starring the now late Anton Yelchin as Pat, alias Shawkat as Sam, Joe Cole as Reese, and Callum Turner as Tiger. Together, they are the Ain't Rights, a hardcore punk band who are in the middle of, actually very near the end of a disastrous tour, which makes sense because they're an extremely mediocre punk band. And it's just the truth. I've been in a mediocre punk band. I know these things. Sort of going from extremely squalid hole in the wall to extremely squalid hole in the wall, doing zine interviews, doing all those punk band things. And one fateful night, they wind up at a neo-Nazi club run by, of all people, Patrick Stewart, where very, very bad things happen and very, very rapidly. And any more than that, I guess we'll get into as we see fit. You know what, Ricky, I got to start again with you because, spoiler alert, you and I love the hell out of this movie. And I know why I love the hell out of this movie, and I don't think it's the same reasons as you. So you may as well go first. Why is Green Room so awesome?
Well, first of all, I love horror films, and I consider this a horror film. I think, I won't say the best film of 2016, but my favorite film of 2016, but I do think it is the best horror film released in 2016. So the movie, first and foremost, works, I think, as a fully immersive experience. But I think if you rewatch the film, I think viewers can unlock several layers. And with multiple viewings, I think you get to absorb and notice things that you won't see upon the first viewing. That said, the first viewing, it is one hell of an incredible experience. I think that this has all the makings of a cult classic. This is how you make a movie that finds a cult following and people are going to be talking about for the next like 15, 20, 30, 40 years. And when people make lists of the best films released in this century, this will be on the list, at least in terms of like genre film. This is his third film. I think it's his best film by far. I think it resembles his first two films, more so Murder Party in the sense that it's very messy, but I think it's actually better than Blue Ruin. I think the cinematography is better. I think the editing is better. I love the sound design, which I have to talk about. So on the surface, it shares a lot in common with his first two films, but I think he just masters his like craft here as a director, as a writer. I think it retains a cinematic flair of Blue Ruin, but again, it looks better. I don't have one bad thing to say about this movie. It has a very straightforward premise. It's simple, but it gets the job done. It's got a brilliant cast, not just Patrick Stewart. I mean, he's fantastic, which we have to talk about his performance, but I'm also the biggest fan of Anton Yelchin. Love him as much as I love Elijah Wood, rest in peace. And I think the whole entire cast delivers like a fantastic performance. I think the movie itself delivers surprise after surprise after surprise, despite its familiar and simple premise. I love the frenetic pace. It is gory at times. It's got these moments of like dark black comedy. I don't know. It's just a fantastic, fantastic film. And I love the way he builds suspense and tension throughout each entire scene. I love the way it feels claustrophobic. It's just an accomplished film. Like, I mean, everything about this film seems right for me. The cast, the music, the editing. It's 94 minutes, dudes. 94 minutes. It's tight, lean. Yeah, this movie is amazing. Love it.
All right, I'm going to be waxing poetic soon enough, but I figured I'd give Patrick a chance to get his words in first.
All right. I liked this movie quite a bit. I watched these basically back to back, and it was nice being in the hands of a pretty assured director. I'm not familiar with Saulnier's earlier work, so this was my first one of his movies. And I definitely agree. Like all the production value is just top notch. I mean, it's totally aces stuff. It looks great and it sounds great and it is cut great. And like you say, I love again, he uses violence as great punctuation. It doesn't linger on gore. It uses it for both shock, surprise, you know, and a little bit of humor at times. Well, I don't know. Less humor than with I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. This is clearly more of a horror film, so the violence isn't funny to me in this one like it was in that one. I did have a problem with the writing. The script, I think, was a little bit of gobbledygook at times. Even though it's an incredibly straightforward premise, they really found a way to put a lot of confusing stuff in there just for the hell of it. I feel like they had more story to this whole thing, especially with the skinheads. There was clearly something going on there that they sort of hint at and they talk about all the time but never really clarify, and there's a lot of mystery thrown into what ultimately happens at the end. But at the same time, that didn't detract from me liking the movie too much. I just, you know, it was something that I noticed. I also hated the punk rock band. I wanted all these characters. As soon as in the first 10 minutes, I was thinking, I'm going to hate this movie. I'm going to hate this freaking movie because I hate every one of these people.
You hated the characters or just the band?
The characters. Their music, of course, was terrible as well. But I hated the characters and I wanted to see them all die. The problem in this is that they were up against skinheads and these were even more despicable people. And so I ultimately had to sort of side with the punk rock band despite, but I still did take some pleasure from their deaths, especially the first two, which I found to be the most annoying characters. So at least they went first.
I don't know, dude. I mean, how often do you get to see a band cover the dead Kennedys, Nazi punks fuck off in front of an actual crowd of actual Nazi punks? Like, that was great.
But then that kind of didn't go anywhere. Like, some people flipped them off and threw a couple things, but it didn't really have any sort of, I don't know, they didn't go anywhere with that. It was kind of a funny thing to do. And that was what made me think these guys are a bunch of jerk-offs. I almost thought they're basically poser punks.
Well, but I think that's the point of the movie. It's like, be careful what you wish for, because they are these wannabe hardcore punk rockers who step into this like dingy venue out in the middle of nowhere, being fully aware that they're going to be playing in front of a bunch of neo-Nazis. And they sort of like, I'm not going to say they ask for what happens to them, because they do fall victim to being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I mean, they, you know, it's like, you guys think you're really hardcore. Well, now do you actually think you're hardcore? And I guess by the end of the film, you can sort of say that some of them are hardcore, you know, given the fact that some of them do survive. But I get what you're saying. But I'm not entirely sure if you're supposed to like the characters. But again, Anton Yelchin's character, Pat, I love him. He becomes sort of like the leader of the group. And he's by far the best. His performance is
okay,
amazing.
Okay, guys,
amazing.
Guys, I gotta ask. If these are wannabe punks, like, what do you think punks are?
I know you could, like, make a point that all punks are wannabe punks, and they're all... I felt like this was actor and director interpretation of actual wannabe punks. How about that? They felt fake to me the entire time.
But Simon, you can't deny that, because in the movie, at the start of the film, like within the very first 50 minutes, like they're getting interviewed by who I think is a wannabe journalist, and they're talking about how the reason why they decide not to be on social media or have an online presence, and like they play themselves out to be bigger than they are. Like they play themselves out to be like the next big punk band and that they are special. And it's okay, like, for you to think as an artist that your music is actually good and you can make it big. There's nothing wrong with being confident and having confidence and chasing your dreams. But let's be honest, they think they're bigger than they are.
I completely disagree. Now, okay, I'm going to rewind and talk about why I personally love this movie. I spend a lot of time in punk venues. I spend a lot of time in metal venues. I also spend time demonstrating against fascists in Toronto. But what I love about this movie is that it's really about sort of the magic of artifice. It's about the magic of believing in something that is outside of yourself. And I think that the Ain't Rights, like, you know, they know they're not good. Like they know they're not a good band. I mean, there's a reason, you know, they play a short set and it features a Dead Kennedys cover that like anyone with half an hour of practice could play. That's what makes a good punk song, by the way. At least a good like OG punk song. I mean, they, you know, I don't really know what would make them more real punks. I mean, they're touring the country like by the skin of their teeth. They're siphoning gas. They're barely eating. They're giving interviews to like crappy local zines. Like, it doesn't really get any more punk than that.
I'm not saying that they aren't real punks or like they're not a real punk band. What I'm saying is that they play themselves off to be like they have this like facade that they're bigger than what they really are. Deep down, like, yeah, they know where they stand. They know they're struggling musicians, but they still let out this facade and they go to this venue and it's fine. Like, you're supposed to do that when you're in the music business or in a show business. You got to actually act like you're bigger than what you are because you want people to look at you that way.
But they're not in it as a business. They don't think of music as a business. Anyway, I'm not going to get into fucking quoting punk lyrics left and right. But, you know, I think they actually earnestly believe in the power of music. They believe in punk as an ideal. And that's why. And yes, that does lead them to like certain pretenses. But I think ultimately, you know, one of the most revealing moments of the movie is, you know, there's this through line of, you know, who's your desert island band, which ends up in a hilarious final sequence between two characters, one of whom finally discloses their desert island band. It doesn't exactly work out, and you know there is, you know, they have these, you know, these really thought through answers about, you know, there are all these very punk rock bands, and you know, ultimately one character very amusingly says Slayer and Madonna, and like to me, like, this, what this movie is really about is the communal feeling of punk and the communal feeling of tapping into a tradition, and also the communal feeling of performativity, like the way that the characters who do end up sort of making it out, they do it not by being smarter and not by being sort of cannier than the people around them. Not really. They do it because they pick a form of artifice and they stick to it with a level of commitment. And that's really all you can do to sort of try to honor the myth of punk rock. And I think it's sort of beautiful and idealistic in a way that a movie like I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore couldn't really allow for. I think it sort of allows these characters a state of grace to survive in.
Well, I think you're totally right. And, you know, when I mentioned the song that they play from the Dead Kennedys, like, they play that song and you have a crowd of like neo-Nazi punks staring at them in confusion, right? And then they proceed to play one of their songs, and then you start to slowly notice everyone in the crowd starts to slowly get into the show. Like, it's like they sort of like form this family unit. It's like they, you know, this is what punk music is about. It's about uniting these people for the love of music, despite the fact that the people on stage performing do not share the same morale or like viewpoints or beliefs has the people they're performing to. But like, the thing about this film, like, again, I have to just talk about it being a horror film. Like this on paper feels or reads like a typical grindhouse film, but when you watch it, it's something more. It's far greater than the schlocky grindhouse films you would watch from like the 70s or like early 80s that went straight to video. Like, but I still like the way the film feels like a mess. Like, it feels clumsy. The actions feel clumsy. Things just happen spontaneously and it's all awkward. Like, on one side of the door, because for the majority of the film, they're locked in the green room, right? And on one side of the door, you have like these neo-Nazi punks run by like Patrick Stewart. He's like the owner of the club, and he's trying to get into the room. And then you have them locking themselves in the room, they're barricading themselves because they're trying to protect themselves. And there are these sudden bursts of violence, but on both sides, like, it feels awkward and messy, and it feels like no one has control of the situation. Not even Patrick Stewart, as calm as he is and as polite as he comes across. Like, they're very polite neo-Nazis. We should just make that clear, right? Yeah, but nobody seems to have control of the situation. And even Patrick Stewart's character, he just wants this to, like, be done with. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't want someone to die. He didn't want this big, huge mess. He didn't want the cops to show up. You know, he's just trying to clean up the mess. Like, he's called in to clean up the mess. And so the violence catches everyone off guard. And that's the thing about the film. It's like, everyone in this film becomes a victim to the violence. Everyone, including the skinheads. Like, the skinheads are painted as evil, but at the end of the day, like, it's just interesting how the prey become the predator, because you get these bunch of, like, kids, like the punk band, like, you know, they wise up and they find ways to survive. But in doing so, they have to be the ones that inflict violence and brutality against these neo-Nazis. And so I like that shift, like, in terms of, like, the power shift. So I don't know. I love the way the film's directed in that sense. And again, like, in terms of, like, a horror film, like, clearly the director has seen a lot of horror movies. He's a fan of the genre. Like, from my understanding, he used to make these zombie films as, like, a teenager, and he was also part of the punk scene. But he doesn't overload the movie with a bunch of, like, references to horror films that he liked growing up. Like, you see little nods here and there, but he doesn't overdo it, and he still plays with typical genre conventions, but again, he doesn't overload it.
I just wanted to quickly say, I'm not trying to pull rank on anyone by claiming to be the most punk rock. I have a 9-to-5. I am not a punk. I like living alone in an apartment, and when boots start flying in the pit, I leave the pit. Like, I'm by no means anyone's hardcore punk. But I do think that, having seen a fair number of punk films, I think this is probably the best punk movie since Hardcore Logo, and before that, Decline of Western Civilization. Like, there aren't many good, I mean, there aren't many good punk movies. There aren't many good rock movies in general, and this is definitely among the very best.
And the two films you mentioned, like, Hardcore Logo is fantastic, but, like, the other one's a documentary. And, like, I'm thinking of, like, Class of 1984, which I would not say is a great movie, no. But yeah, they don't make too many movies like this, and they really should.
Okay. Empty out your pockets.
Come search me, faggot.
Just shoot him.
Can I get up?
On the chair. Slowly, slowly. Turn him out. Come on, man, another one.
Oh, fuck. Good call.
Turn it out, for fuck's sake. What is that? Give that to me. Hand it over.
Oops. Wait, was that a phone?
Oh, shit. Pointed at the door.
Maybe it's the police. It's a raid.
Are you serious?
Fuck off, Ilsa.
Yo, quiet. Okay, Justin, yo, don't move. Nobody move.
No, if we get all behind
you. Nobody talk.
Careful now.
Yeah, and when I say, I guess I should have clarified that I don't buy the actors as punks. How about that? That's more what it is, more so than the characters. There's just some feeling there that I got that this was too actory on the punks. But, I mean, regardless of that, I do. I think I love the way that this movie also gave off kind of like a Assault on Precinct 13 sort of vibe to me as well. I love the whole standoff situation, and that it's messy like that one was. I felt like there was an element of control exerted by the Nazis. Like, they definitely had a solid plan. Like, they were doing fairly well. And I think if the movie falls apart a little bit for me, and it does just a bit, it is, again, we always say this, it's at the end. The final tactic that the punks use is kind of ridiculous to me. And I get what they're going for. I totally get what they're going for. It's the punk way, right? I think that in no universe this would have possibly worked out as well as it did for these punks. But so be it. I get that he shot for it. He shot for this whole punk theme and, you know, chaos. And he wanted to make that work, so he made it work in the script. It didn't work for me, but the rest of the movie I felt was just the rest of the time I thought he was doing a fantastic job of showcasing sort of this cool, cold, heartless logic that the Nazis used for the most part, versus the sort of panic and disarray that was on the side of the punks.
God damn it, Patrick. Like, I'm looking at how he tells the movie visually, like, aesthetically, like, I love the movie. But then, like, when I talk to Patrick all the time about movies. Like, I have to remember he's a screenplay writer. I'm like, yeah, so he, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like you're always focused heavily on the screenplay. But I just love, yeah, but I love the way he has, like, this total control of the camera. Like, I love the way he gets this claustrophobic feel of these guys, because the whole thing takes place mostly in, like, one location, right? And it takes place within, I believe, 16 hours, so, like, in a day. And there's little fanfare to the violence and gore. Like, there, it is at times violent and gory, but there's a lot of violence that's played off camera. Like, it's in the shadows, or you hear it in the background. So there's no glorification of the violence. And I just, I don't know. Like, I love the sound design, too. Like, there's one specific moment where they use the loudspeakers, like the feedback, in order to, what's the word I'm looking
repel
for?
Repel them, like, basically?
Repel, yeah, the dogs, right? So, like, the use of, and, like, it's not just, like, in terms of, like, the sound editing and the sound, quote-unquote, effects or sound design, even, like, the way, like, you know, we do get, like, of course, we get scenes in which we hear punk music, right? Like, when they put on the record, but, like, right away, like, they put the needle on the record, and right away it cuts to the next scene, and you don't even hear the song. And then when they play the Dead Kennedy song, like, it lasts, like you said, Simon, like, maybe, like, a minute, not even, and then they go on to the next song, but then it quickly cuts. Like, they don't, like, focus on this band playing for like 5 minutes, like, which a lot of directors would do. They would add padding to the movie, and that's why this movie's like brisk. It moves along so quickly. It's got this great pacing, great editing, and again, going back to how claustrophobic it feels, like, throughout the whole entire film, like, even when they actually get out of the green room, which they do at one point, it still feels claustrophobic. And so there's just something about the way the camera heightens the suspense and the band's sense of confinement, even when they actually do find a way out of the green room. Like, they always feel like they're trapped. Credit due to the cinematographer, but credit due to the director as well. And the cinematographer, I believe, was Sean Porter, and he's always fantastic. So, and honestly, like, we haven't even talked about Patrick Stewart yet.
Well, I want to talk about Patrick Stewart in a minute, but I wanted to counter this idea that the screenplay isn't tight or sort of loosens as it goes, because I really don't think that's true. I mean, I think that you have these characters who are in this unfamiliar surroundings, and in these unfamiliar surroundings, rather, where there's all these sort of internal, personal, and political relationships sort of that have already been percolating for a long time and that they really don't understand, which I think is best embodied in the Imogen Poots character, who is sort of the X factor between both of these parties, because she has this complicated relationship with the scene. Like, she claims, you know, she's not really a Nazi, but she, you know, obviously doesn't really mind sort of floating around in these circles. And so there's this weird tension to that character, which is, you know, not totally unlike being at, for instance, a black metal show and not knowing if you start chatting up someone, are they going to start telling you about white pride? But, you know, there's, I think it's believable that, you know, the first of all, the fact that so much of this movie, which is so, this is so rare to especially horror films, so much of the plot of the movie is premised around the Nazis not wanting to go to fucking jail. Like, they actually, they want to be able to cover it up. They want a believable cover story, and they have a plan A, B, C, D, all it, to the point where the extent to which they're a well-oiled machine is almost what's not believable.
Also, Simon, you're right, but also, just quickly, this is a rare horror film in which it's a contest of wit and wills between the victims, the prey, and the predators. And again, there is that shift in balance and power halfway through the film. And so it's about how the punk band can find ways to get out of the situation, but at the same time, the same applies to the neo-Nazis who are trying to get out of like a sticky situation.
Yeah, which is,
they, like you said,
yeah, which is extremely rare. And that aspect feels more like a true crime film than a horror film. And to pivot over to Patrick Stewart, I have to say it took me two viewings for Patrick Stewart's performance to really work for me. The first time I actually thought maybe he was miscast because he's so soft-spoken, he's so restrained, he's so not hammy, except in these rare moments like we got to get the push broom. You know, stuff like that is actually really funny. That's a great line and great delivery. But at first I thought maybe, you know, they overshot by, you know, they had an opportunity to use this kind of A-list actor in a weird role, and maybe it didn't quite work. But the second viewing, his quiet menace and his almost this level of reasonableness that is so insidious and makes me think of white power, like crypto fascist white power figureheads like Richard Spencer, who sound reasonable when they're talking, and then when you really parse out what they're saying, you realize that they're fucking insane. That's what he made me think of. Like, it makes total sense that a guy like this would be running a place like this, because you need someone like that to keep cops off your back. And
you're fucking insane, because he's amazing in this film.
No, and like, it took me that second viewing to really get it.
He's like the most magnetic performance. There's no question he's the most magnetic performance in this movie. Everything he says, and you know, he might be partially to blame for some of the reason I find the latter half of the movie sort of unbelievable, because he is so calm and seems so logical about everything, like he's done this before, like he's done this plenty of times. And yes, there's the element of they just want to get this thing over with and they don't like the situation whatsoever, but he also seems like he's been through something like this before. And the situation that they have the punks in is pretty much an unescapable situation if you think about it in real life. This is a movie, however, so obviously things must happen so that it can go on. But I feel like he kind of ruins, he takes me out of the believability of the world, because I firmly believe that a guy like this would have dealt with the problem, no problem. And that doesn't end up happening because of a series of inconceivable blunders that these Nazis make that the script needs them to. So right. That's my problem. Like, his performance, though, is while he convinced me that he's super smart, and that may be part of the problem, I still was drawn to him all the time. I loved his delivery. His soft delivery was a great choice rather than going for a blustery, evil guy.
But the thing is, he's not at fault. It's the fault of the people he surrounds himself with, like his assistant and the neo-Nazis. Like, they're the ones that fuck up. Like, and the thing about him is, like, he's terrifying, he's calm, he's domineering. It's like a wonderful, scary performance, and he's always in control of his character. And I think the director scored a masterful coup of against type casting. Like, this is not the typical role that Patrick Stewart would play. Like, this is a guy who normally plays like Shakespeare or Star Trek, right? And it's just great to see him in this role, in this indie film, and playing this villain. And also, like, again, like, I mean, he's sort of in control, but not really, because he plays his cards right. Like, he does everything that he should do in order to get himself out of the situation, but it's everyone around him that screws everything up. And that's the thing about violence. Like, a lot of times, like, you can't control what happens afterwards. Like, and I think the thing about this movie is, to some degree, it's not even really about what we see happening, like the actions that we see happening, like the violence. It's about the aftermath.
Almost the sort of the last thing I want to say, because we do need to start thinking about wrapping up soon, is that I think sort of one of the other reasons that I think this is such a great punk movie is that there is this divergence of tactics between the Nazis and the band, where, the Nazis they live by these codes. You even see it in the way they dress and the way that they have these tiers between them of the people who are, laced up and they're the ones who you really need to, the red laces, there's the people that they know they can count on when shit gets real. And then there's sort of the normie neo-Nazis who aren't gonna sully themselves with violence. They have these elaborate systems and these elaborate plans. And the band, they're making it up on the fly. And what's brilliant about the way that they're characterized and their tactics in the film is that they're tacticians in the same way that they're a punk band. When they find a tactic that works, like, for instance, taping up a horrible wound with duct tape, or like using a fire extinguisher to conceal themselves, they pretty much do the same things over and over because they know that it works. Much like a punk band will play the same three chords because they know that it's effective. There's a certain amount of cleverness, particularly as you get nearer to the end. There's some inventive use of a couch, for instance, but which was a beautiful, beautiful shot. But like, really, they're getting by in the skin of their teeth with the very few resources you have, and it doesn't get much more DIY than that.
And that's, I think that's where it also, that's where the movie kind of loses me a bit. Even though I like, what holds up during all of that is that Saulnier shoots and edits the entire thing and stages. Like, I love his staging. He uses his frames really well, composition. That holds up throughout the entire film. But the tactics of the punk band, I mean, realistically, when you look at the situation they're in, nobody's getting out of there. Patrick Stewart convinces them to hand over something that as soon as that's gone, it's over. You're done. You have no way to realistically defend yourself in an actual scenario like that. But like I say, this is movie world, and they concoct blunders. Like, that nobody could possibly, I mean, the Nazis have to go out of their way to screw this up, is what I'm saying. They actually have to go out of the way. And I know they want to romanticize the punk tactics, but that was the most unintentionally hilarious part of the movie for me. The only unintentionally hilarious part of the movie for me, actually, because the rest of it's all very, very solid and tight. But that little bit at the end where they go full on punk, that was so ridiculous and over the top that it took me out of it.
The actual last thing I'll say is that I think what saves the movie in terms of its believability is the fact that their tactics backfire as often as they work. You know, not everyone makes it out. Things go wrong and they have to improvise in a totally new way on a spur of the moment, which I think happens in some beautifully choreographed sequences near the end. And, you know, like, I think if the movie had progressed in a rosier fashion, I might agree with you. But there's nothing in this movie about the way people behave or sort of the way these internal factions and politics and interrelationships end up complicating things. I think it all, especially on rewatch, and also especially with subtitles on, because I found that some of the dialogue is a little bit difficult to make out, especially with all the noise. And when I was able to pick up on every bit of dialogue, I really found that I couldn't really detect any plot or character fissures.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that he set out to make a horror film, like, first and foremost. Yeah. And so as a horror film, like, I can overlook all of those, like, quote-unquote flaws that Patrick was, like, pointing out, because, like, the thing is, like, you don't go watch Fast and Furious and be like, well, that's impossible, the car can't actually jump like that far, you know what I mean? But, like, you know, he's playing with the conventions and the tropes of the horror genre, but he's doing it in interesting new ways. And I think the movie still has a lot to say about violence, about the punk scene, and, like, just about how we deal with these unexpected circumstances. I mean, like, maybe we've never found ourselves in a situation quite like that, but I'm sure each and every single one of us have come across a situation that's sort of, like, unexpected. It puts us in an awkward position, and we have to try to find a way to get out. Again, this is to an extreme, but there is, like, a sense of, like, them trying to find ways to work as a team and interact with these people. And, like, I mean, because, like, a good portion of the film, like, they're trying to talk their way out. Like, there's two sides negotiating here, right? And so I like the whole, I don't know, je ne sais quoi, like, the, not the chemistry, but the...
It's fantastic stuff. Like, yeah. I loved listening to that. Like, I loved them trying to sort of worm their way out of this horrible situation. And I loved hearing the other side, who you could genuinely tell did not want to be in this situation either. Like, the villains, you're right, they didn't want to be that. And I thought that was a fascinating thing. By the way, I am not at all saying that I did not like this movie. And I totally understand that it takes some liberties because it is a horror movie. It's just that every now and again, you know how you're watching a film and something, it's like they struck the wrong chord for a second and it brings me out of it. For just a second, I'm taken out of what was otherwise a really good song. And so that happened to me a couple of times, but I really, really did like this movie quite a bit. Like, this is, like you were saying, it was, you know, the best horror movie of the year. I totally agree with you.
There was a lot of good horror films in 2016, but this was by far my favorite. And again, like, I love Anton Yelchin, and I do kind of understand how his transformation towards the end of the film feels slightly unrealistic and kind of, like, maybe unneeded, unnecessary, but I like it. I like how he transforms and he becomes so similar to the people who were terrorizing him earlier on. And I think that's the point of that transformation. And his performance is just fantastic. In terms of, like, the rest of the cast, like, I don't think there's anyone that's outstanding. I think, like, apart from the girl, I forget her name. So those three actors, like, are a highlight. Like, they shine on screen in this film, and they themselves, like, their performance is worth the price of admission. But I watched this movie three times already. The first time I watched it with my nephew, and he was blown away. Like, it was like, for him, Green Room is sort of like what Evil Dead 2 was for me as a kid. You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't watch many genre films. He just started watching a lot of genre films. And so we were watching all of these films over the summertime, and he watched this and he was blown away. Like, he loved it. So,
yeah. The last thing I'll say, and this is, I promise, the last time I'm going to pull the punk card, is that the last thing I'll say is that this movie really beautifully captures, and I think this is what makes it such a great punk film. It captures the fun of being in a punk band. I know that sounds like a weird thing to say in a movie where so many terrible things happen, but I feel like it really captures sort of the energy of playing on stage with your shitty punk band. And I remember when I was in high school, like, going on a very brief, I know it wasn't even a tour. We just went out of town for one date. And I remember I was the vocalist because I couldn't do anything else. I was bad at that also. And I remember there was a particular moment where this big guy came up on stage while we were playing. And I really didn't have anything that I could do except scream at him, because I was screaming already anyway. So I just kept looking at him and screaming, and then eventually he left. And it was like, what else was I gonna? I wasn't going to fight him. He was like twice my size. I was just a kid. And it's just like, in those moments, you make a decision, and that's what these characters do. In these moments, they make decisions, and they get by on the skin of their teeth. And I'm not saying I was in any real danger. I recognize that I was not. But I do think that the movie captures the sort of the fun and the spontaneity of punk rock, and then of course it also finds the flip side where it does attract these real terrible elements and always has, and I think it manages that duality while also sort of respecting the romantic side of the rock and roll myth in a very sort of beautiful way, and I hope that I haven't been a total bore about explaining that.
And it's got Anton Yelchin.
And it's got Anton Yelchin, rest in peace.
And it's got dogs.
It does have dogs, but not what? Were you a fan of these dogs too, Ricky?
Oh, come on. Towards the end, did you not feel for that dog?
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
These dogs are victims too, really.
That's true. All right. The movie is Green Room. I think we've already gone a little bit long for our standards, and certainly it's not very cool to go long on an episode about a punk movie. I wanted to talk a little bit more about what connects these movies, but I mean, I guess I don't have much more to say other than that. I think it's fascinating that we have this sort of potential sort of new breed of American genre movie that kind of, that sort of uses perhaps the anxiety of the underclass as a way to sort of, evoke a certain emotional landscape. And you could even connect it to a movie like Don't Breathe, but I guess that'll be a discussion for another time, and I'm sure we'll have occasion to discuss one or both of these filmmakers again. Thank you both. Do visit swordofcinema.com, subscribe, all that good stuff, rate and review us. We appreciate these things very much, and do hit us up on Twitter. I'm there at HollowMinds. Ricky, you run the Goomba Stomp Mag and Sworded Cinema Twitters. And Patrick, where can people find you?
I sort of run the NExpress Nintendo podcast, which is also on Goomba Stomp, that Rick and I host together with Tim Mason. That is at NExpress Nintendo.
And let's take it out with some punk music so I can stop talking.
People